And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usery, and my guest this week is Katie Simpson Smith, who earned a PhD in history from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and an MFA from Bennington. She's published one nonfiction work, We Have Raised All of You, Motherhood in the South, 1750 to 1835, and last year her debut novel, The Story of Land and Sea, was published, and it's now available in paperback from Harper Perennial. Katie, your novel opens in 1793 on the Atlantic coast of North Carolina. There's a young girl named Tabitha, and she's asking her father about her mother. Why doesn't Tabitha know her mother?
Tabitha's mother, Helen, has died during childbirth, so the girl grew up not knowing her at all. When Helen passed away, she left behind her husband, John, who is an ex-pirate and ex-continental soldier, who is moving to the new challenge of single fatherhood with his daughter Tabitha in this small town on the coast of North Carolina.
It's almost a bit of irony that he was in the Revolutionary War fighting on the side of the colonies, and when he gives up the privateering life and the fighting life, he becomes a shopkeeper, and England, of course, famously being referred to as a nation of shopkeepers.
I think something similar happens in America, too. We forget that these men and women are from a heritage of English fathers and English grandfathers, and that lineage continues even after the colonies revolt. They rarely stop thinking of themselves as English in that first generation after the Revolution.
It is a big theme in the book. So many of the characters don't have the benefit of maternal love in their upbringing. It's like almost every character, except one prominent character, doesn't have his mother around, it seems like.
And I think this was common, too, in this time period, that childbirth was such a perilous point in a woman's life, that you have so many children growing up motherless and so many fathers trying to navigate this new landscape of parenthood, not having any of the tools to do so. They're not raised with the expectation that they will one day have to dress their daughters and educate their daughters. That burden is totally placed on women's shoulders. And then if a woman dies during childbirth, the family is left unable to cope in her absence. So one of the things this book really explores is how men deal with the absence of women in their lives. And I think to a large extent, these characters rise to the challenge.
It's interesting because you have a PhD in history, and you did write a book on motherhood in early America. And so you decide for your second book, well, let's just do away with all the moms together.
Yeah. I almost feel like motherhood was done. Like, I had finished the project on motherhood in the late 18th and early 19th century. I'd done extensive research, and I was almost exhausted of the topic because it's a very difficult subject to write about because it's so often tragic. And you so often see women struggling to maintain power and control over their own families. And so writing about fathers was a way for me to explore uncharted territory. As a fiction writer, I think we always gravitate towards those exotic things that we wish we understood better. And for me, I will never get to know what it's like to be a father. And so writing about fatherhood was a way to allow myself to explore that alternative world.
So do you just take a negative of your book and say, take out these elements that I learned about motherhood in those years and that's what we're left with? And
almost, yeah. But there's so much about fatherhood that, you know, I didn't expect to uncover when I was writing. And I learned a lot just through the characters' trajectories. When Asa loses his wife and then his daughter, is left in this empty world. And the only thing he can turn to is religion, and yet religion has seemed to have abandoned him as well. So getting into those character psyches was just fascinating for me as a writer.
And it's more than just men losing the women in their lives, because the middle section of the book, part two, has a lot to do with Helen, who is John's wife and Asa's daughter, who dies in childbirth, but we see that she's raised without a mother herself.
Right. So the central part of the book deals with these two girls, Helen and an enslaved girl named Moll, who is given to her as a birthday gift. And there's this vibrancy, I think, in their growing into their womanhood that kind of echoes the lack of women in the other parts of the book. So we see what lives could be like if these women were still around. And that relationship between Helen and Moll was a very tricky one to write because I wanted to do justice to the fact that relationships between women in slavery were never equal. There was no natural sympathy between women. And I think some people assume that women were somehow kinder or more empathetic or understanding towards Black women. And that's simply not the case. And so trying to write these two girls who, because they're basically the only women on this plantation, are thrown into a natural friendship, but that friendship is always colored by an uneven power dynamic. So trying to make those characters believable and sympathetic to the reader, but also not sugarcoating any of the power dynamic between them.
Because we see what's probably the grossest birthday present I've ever heard of in a book is when Helen receives Maul as her 10th birthday present.
Right. And then we immediately think, as readers, how can we ever admire Helen or her father? These are evil characters in an evil system. And yet this is what life looked like back then. And if you can't find little nuggets of sympathy for all of the people around you, then you're going to end up being a very sad and unhappy person.
Well, it's a nice contrast to Tabitha. For her birthday, she wants a model ship,
yeah.
The symbol of freedom, of getting away from land.
Right. She's such a tomboy and almost the opposite of Helen. Helen is almost upset that she's given a slave because she wants ribbons or a hairbrush instead. Tabitha, I think because she grows up with this absence of women in her life, is very wild and ungoverned, and she romanticizes the ocean and her father's pirate past. And so what she wants for her birthday is a boat. She wants to be able to open the trap door and put things in it, which is very different from Helen's upbringing.
And of course, Maul has suffered from this lack of maternal love as well because she was taken away from her mother at a very early age.
Exactly. We don't know what happened to her mother. There's no history there. There's no name that she can hold on to. And as a result, when she becomes a mother, there are no models for her. And she makes very difficult decisions about how to parcel out her love and how to raise these children in a way that is fulfilling to herself, but is not entirely neglectful of those around her.
She talks about how she made a mistake with her first child, and that's the mistake was loving him.
Exactly. Love, which seems like an only positive thing from our modern perspective, becomes a huge liability in slavery.
The relationship between Helen and Maul, how uncommon was it for an enslaved person to have that much latitude in their speaking with the person who enslaved them?
Right. I think part of Maul's uniqueness is the fact that she's a slave on this plantation on the coast of North Carolina in a very small town on a plantation that grows trees for turpentine. So unlike large-scale cotton plantations or rice plantations where there would have been 400 or 500 slaves and the system of control would have been much more complete from the slave owner's perspective, these small plantations and small towns usually employed only a few slaves. Employed is the wrong word. And these slaves were able to make lives for themselves with slightly more autonomy than slaves on larger scale plantations. So they would have been able to sometimes hire themselves out for a small amount of money or to sell their produce or eggs. And for Maul in particular, she's the only slave that's sort of brought into the house. And because Asa is wifeless and is sort of in his own head about the plantation business, he's not present in a way that would lead to control of Maul in the way that we think of slave owners controlling their slaves. So her outspokenness, I don't think, is uncommon for these particular scenarios. And it reminds us that slaves were not always completely beaten down and dehumanized, but that they still continue to fight back and to vocalize in whatever ways that they could.
But it's also healthy for us to remember that these men who were fighting for freedom from the British were enslaving people in the process.
Exactly. And the idea that there are good guys and bad guys, those lines become very blurry when you put slavery in the mix and when you think about the way our Constitution was written. And I think people look at the American Revolution as a very sort of heavily idealistic war, but you have to separate what those ideals were from the ideals that we hold today, which include sort of basic human rights and human equality.
Early in the book, young Tabitha falls ill to Yellow Jack. She gets yellow fever, and it's just not going well for her.
that was a particularly difficult part of the book to write because I had to do a lot of research on the symptoms of yellow fever and the cures for yellow fever.
And this was 100 years before they even knew what caused yellow fever.
They had no idea. And so you get really wacky ideas for how to fix it.
The miasma.
Yeah. Vapors just floating up from the earth that must be causing it. And there would be bloodletting and blistering along the back.
Oh, like in The Madness of King George.
Yes.
Did you see the movie?
The cupping. Yeah. So I got to read the diaries of Benjamin Rush, who is sort of the most famous revolutionary doctor, who goes to Philadelphia in 1793, where there's a huge outbreak, and tries to figure out how to cure it. And he's writing these letters to his wife, which was pretty unusual, detailing all of the very gory symptoms. So reading those was a way to get into the mindset of these characters in the book who would have known what the symptoms meant but had absolutely no sense of how to cure them. So the characters of John and Asa take completely different tacks when it comes to how to cure Tabitha. Asa is convinced that she needs to stay with him and that his faith and his prayer will help cure her. But John, who prayed when his wife was in childbirth and still God took her away from him, has a very different relationship with religion. And his idea is to take her out to sea, which, you know, she of course loves, because he has a sense of the ocean as a very peaceful place and a place where he had so much happiness in his life.
And it mirrors their relationship with Helen and what happened in John and Helen's relationship.
Right. John took Helen out to sea. They sort of eloped after Asa refused to give his permission for them to be married. And their year on the ocean was just filled with love and joy, and he's trying to recreate that.
With John essentially losing his faith, during Helen's life, we learned that she was very adamant in her faith. Not maybe necessarily the religious part of it, but very strong in her faith in God. But we learned that Asa has the line that's attributed, to his thought process. Without believing in God of salvation and forgiveness, he has faith in God the Punisher.
In this period of American history, that's almost all that you see. You see God wreaking havoc in your life and the lives of those around you. And it's very hard to rationalize a God that is loving and forgiving, especially for these characters.
And so he did come to his faith, but it was only through loss and viewing that as punishment did he get his faith.
Right. It's a kind of bleak outlook.
The book is unusual in that it's told in the present tense. There's not a whole lot of novels told in the present tense. Why did you decide to adopt that approach?
For me, historical fiction is often read at a great remove. It's easy to see it as something that happened in the past and reassuringly is over and done with. And I really wanted this book to resonate with modern readers, which is difficult given how different this time period was and how different these people's lives are from our own. But putting it in the present tense, I think, gives it an immediacy that forces the reader to make connections between the late 18th century and the early 21st century, to realize that loss looks the same whether you're wearing a powdered wig or whether you're living in the modern era, and that these characters, the way they grapple with that and the way they overcome it, I think offer lessons for us today.
Now, did you start with that approach or did you come to it a little bit later in the process?
I had maybe written a chapter in the past tense and felt that something was wrong and it wasn't working. And I remember clearly taking a walk. I live in New Orleans and I took a walk to the bayou to clear my head. I was trying to think, okay, why is this not working? How can I fix it? Is it a little fix or is it a big change that I need to make? And I was about 2 blocks from the bayou when I thought, present tense. And I ran home and I tried it for a paragraph and all of a sudden it felt like the narrative came alive.
And you never slipped back into the
nope.
past tense? In the author's note, you talk about how there are true historical antecedents for some of the occurrences and some of the characters in the book. Was there really a slave named Moll?
There was not a slave named Moll.
I thought Moll Flanders.
Right.
Was the first thing I could do.
Right. There certainly were slaves named Moll. I took her name from a list of slaves from that time period. But there's so little documentary evidence for slave life in this time period that we have no way of knowing if there was an enslaved girl who would have been outspoken, who would have had this relationship with a white woman. But we can piece together various different lives, either from plantation records or from slave narratives that were written in the 19th century, to create this character that I think probably did exist at some point.
She has an 11-year-old boy in the more contemporary sections of the book named Davy. And it's interesting to contrast the way they approach and see life, because he hasn't known this love, so he doesn't know this pain that everyone else has felt from the lack of maternal love. And at one point it's said that his mother, in terms of religion, sees that the devil comes to you in ways that you don't recognize, in people and things that you don't know. And later it's said that Davy only wants to see things he's never seen before.
Yeah. To me, Davy is the most optimistic character in the book and the one who offers the most hope for the reader. And again, with him, I really wanted to push against this idea of slave life being completely dehumanized. We don't think of a young boy in slavery having bravery or spunk or an ability to sort of talk back to those around him. But those are traits that are common to boyhood, no matter what state you're in or what condition you're in. And I really wanted him to sort of exemplify all of the aspects that the other characters in the book are still searching for. They're still searching for hope and reasons to live. And meanwhile, his natural curiosity and interest in the world around him and desire to see new things and different things is what takes him, you know, with John out to Tennessee. It's what takes him away from this stage of grief that the other characters continue to live in.
And there is so much grief,
yes,
in this book. So at some point, do you go, how are the readers going to react to this? What am I doing to people by just kind of saying, well, here's the pit, come on down with me?
Yeah, I feel like readers go into two camps. There are so many readers who have said this is too dark and too depressing. And then there are readers who really see it as an ultimately hopeful and uplifting book. And I'm really glad that there are readers who took it in the way that I intended it, which is that we all face degrees of loss in our lives, and we all face some of the things that these characters do. But the fact that these characters nonetheless continue to live and continue to wake up each morning and go about their daily business and figure out how to make a life for themselves. For instance, Asa at the end of the book teaches himself how to cook and is trying to be a plantation owner even when his plantation is falling apart and everyone he loves has left him. That's, I think, the root of all human hope, is how you continue to be an individual when everything else is gone. And so for me, it's a very uplifting book.
Davy does share something with Helen, of course, whom he never met. And that's that they both like to keep little keepsakes, little treasures they both have. And that's, I guess, showing some kind of hope and some fondness for their lives.
Absolutely. It's sort of a combination of nostalgia for what they've seen and what they've witnessed, but also the sense that maybe one day they'll have someone to share those treasures with and to tell about their lives.
I just thought it was interesting that they were probably the two most hopeful characters, and they shared that trait.
Yeah, I like that interpretation.
Now, this is the paperback release.
Yes.
Of The Story of Land and Sea, and oftentimes there's a Q&A with the author at the back of the paperback release, especially for book clubs, and you had a very special person give you questions in your Q&A.
Yes, I had an interview with the character of Davy at the end. So Davy is asking me about my writing process and my background. I remember when my editor said, you know, we need to do a Q&A for the back of the book, and would you like me to provide you with questions? I said, well, that sounds kind of dull. I would rather have an interview with someone a little bit more lively. And so I thought of Davy, and he's the character that I still sort of miss. I miss being able to write about him and to see what he thinks and says and does. So it was such a treat to dive back into his imagination for that interview.
How do you ask yourself in someone else's voice those questions?
I think it's just the imaginative leap that the writer always takes. So it was just another way to be a part of that, to insert myself into the world of the novel again, I guess.
Did you surprise yourself in that process of what he would ask you?
Yes. At the end, he asked me where I got my coat, which is what he asked John earlier in the book. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's the Davy I know and love.
You had researched this time period before, how much additional research did you have to do in the course of drafting the book?
I had to do a great deal. I thought I was beating the system by having all my research done in advance. I thought, okay, I'm coming out of this PhD program with a wealth of research. I've read, you know, hundreds of letters and diaries and plantation accounts, missionary journals, and that really gave me the confidence to write about this period because I knew basically how people thought and how people spoke. But once I started writing the particular story, there were so many little details that came up that I had to fact check or had to learn more about. For instance, John being a pirate, a lot of the action takes place on ships, and I've never been on a sailing ship. And so I had to do a lot of research into the parts of the ship and what goes where and how pirates would have interacted with each other and, you know, the rules when you're on the ocean. Yellow fever is another example of something that I had to get into that I didn't have any knowledge about before. There's a Revolutionary War battle that takes place, the Battle of Beaufort, which is actually the last battle of the Revolution. It happens several months after the British officially surrender at Yorktown, but Beaufort hasn't gotten the news that the war is over. And so these British ships come in and set siege to the harbor. And so I had to read about, you know, how they came in and how long they were there and what they did to the townspeople and how the townspeople responded. Because it's hard to be as accurate as possible and still put the imagination first. I think for a lot of fiction writers who have historical backgrounds, it's very easy to let the history overswamp the story. And I really made a point of putting the story first at all times, even though that was difficult with my particular background.
And it was really interesting to see that siege and kind of the soldiers' attitudes toward battle, because it wasn't necessarily kill them all, let God sort them out, you know, all fight all the time. There was a little bit of play, a little bit of quarter given to each other when it would have been a hassle to fight. So they just kind of let each other do their own thing.
Right. And I think part of that is because these were people who looked like them and sounded like them and enjoyed tea as much as they did. So there isn't an easy way to make enemies out of them in the same way that so many other wars of religion or wars between very different countries have exoticized the enemy soldier in such a way that it's very easy to kill them without thinking twice about it. This was a war where you really had to reckon with the fact that these were people very similar to yourself.
It didn't help much in the Civil War, though.
No. But still, there was so much personal anxiety in the Civil War, even with the massive amounts of death, that I don't think we see today as much.
Now, did you choose the Inner Banks of North Carolina because you had been a PhD student at the University of North Carolina?
Yes, absolutely. When I was in that PhD program, I tried to escape Chapel Hill as often as I could. And so I would take day trips down to the beach. And that's when I first visited the town of Beaufort and was very inspired by its history.
There was one thing that really caught my attention, and it was at Christmas time. And I've read this before. Slaves would say to the people that enslaved them, Christmas gift, and expect some little token on Christmas Day. And that's because in my family, we had a tradition of Christmas Eve gift. And the first person to arise on Christmas Eve and say to another family member, Christmas Eve gift, had to receive an additional gift.
Oh, wow.
And it would just be some little token.
Right.
But I found out that my family originally came from North Carolina, at least in America. And then that's most likely where it came from.
Absolutely. My family says Christmas gift on Christmas morning, and the first person to say it, like, wins the day. And I grew up thinking of that as such a fun tradition. And my people are from South Carolina. And then when I first heard about that being embedded in the slave system and that slaves were sort of conditioned to say it, to ask for some small favor on Christmas Day when, of course, the big house was celebrating extravagantly. It just sort of chilled my blood for a moment. But it's a good reminder that we live with the legacy of slavery in so many aspects of our lives today.
Now, this is your first novel that's been published. Did you have any others in the drawer before this one?
No, this is the first one I ever wrote.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I had a terrible time of finishing things before I started my MFA program. I worked on stories and a couple of novellas, but could never actually finish a project until I had teachers saying, you know, the next chapter is due and the next chapter is due. And now you have to write the final chapter. And that was a godsend in forcing me to structure a project and complete it. So I'm very grateful to them for that.
And I did see that you're staying in the past and in the South for your next novel.
Yes, my next novel is coming out in February, and it's called Free Men. And it's set in a very similar time, 1788, in South Alabama. And it follows a group of three men, one white, one black, and one Native American, who band together despite their very different backgrounds and inadvertently become highway robbers. So it's more of an adventure story.
I'm really looking forward to that, Katie.
Thank you.
I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your book with us today. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure's been mine.
Katie Simpson-Smith is the author of the novel, The Story of Land and Sea, which is published by Harper Perennial. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752. You can find information on upcoming tapings and broadcasts of Book Talk, as well as download podcasts at our blog, WIPLFMBookTalk.blogspot.com.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WIPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.